Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm pleased to introduce our guest teacher today, the Reverend Conan O'Connor of Milwaukee Zen Center. She has been the resident priest and head teacher there since 2001. She's a Dharma era of Tozon Akiyama Roshi Sensei. Not quite sure.
He won't use any of the titles, but in his absence, I say Roshi.
Okay. Roshi. She trained at the Toyama Nisodo, the Keisei Zendo, Kokyoji, Shogoji, and Hoshinji monasteries in Japan. She serves on the board of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections Religious Practices Advisory Committee. Prior to entering the Zen world, she had a 40-year career in nonprofit theater, and she's the former president of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association in America. So, thank you.
Thanks.
I'm greatly honored to have you.
Well, it's great to be here. I'm going to try to speak loudly enough. If I trail off, please, people out there, yell at me, do something. Because I generally speaking, I don't have trouble being heard, but I'm not sure because of there's so many of you. It's very nice. I'm really honored to be here and honored to be asked. And inevitably, when someone invites you to do a Dharma talk, your first thought is, you know, oh Lord, what will I say? And your mind goes blank, which I suppose in this business we think is a sort of virtue, but the difficulty is something should emerge from the blankness if you can manage it. Because of that little process, which I go through every time I have to do a Dharma talk, I realized that I wanted to talk about where all those thoughts come from. We all come to a place like this seeking something. At least that's the first impulse. We're looking for understanding. We're looking for peace. We're looking for some kind of a better life. There is some impulse that brings us to the door. When we get inside the door, almost the first thing that someone says to us is, stop seeking. Because that, in a way, is your problem. And going beyond that, in terms of what impedes us from opening up, I found rising in my mind a silly phrase, which is actually, I put it down as the title of this talk, and Rosemary laughed when she saw it. It says, it's your mind, stupid. It is indeed our biggest problem. Is our mind. And it's not a new problem. The fifth patriarch of Zen, so we're talking about the 7th century in China, a man named Hung Jen, is quoted in the Platform Sutra, admonishing his students. And he said something that to me is very interesting. All those hundreds of years ago, he said, I tell you, for people in this world, the matter of birth and death is serious. You lot just seek fields of blessings all day long and do not seek to get out of the ocean of misery of birth and death. If your own nature is confused, how can blessings save you? That's a critical question. We come seeking the blessing of peace of mind, let's say, or peace in the world. That's one thing, and it's not basic enough. He says, let each of you look into your own wisdom and grasp the insightful nature of your own basic mind. Have you ever tried to do that? There are many stories in our literature about people being unable to find the basic mind. Because we're looking for our mind with our mind. There's another famous Zen saying that says, you know, the eye cannot see itself. It's a simple statement, but I cannot see my eyes. I can look in a mirror or a photograph, but that's not the reality. It's a reflection or a snapshot. And if I use my mind to find my mind. I'm occupying my mind with that search, and I'm in a funny little double bind. But the Platform Sutra is really the story of, in the section I'm quoting, it's from a little section they call autobiography, of the sixth patriarch of Zen, a man named Huineng, who was enormously important, and probably without Huineng we wouldn't all be sitting here. Because up until Huineng, there was transmission of Zen understanding from Bodhidharma, who came from India, one patriarch, one ancestor, to one ancestor. But Huineng, and there was a reason for it that's very interesting, I'll tell you in a minute, had a lot of students. And they spread out across China, and the rest is quite literally history. One of the reasons that this happened was that when Huineng was made the sixth patriarch by Hongzhen, the sixth patriarch gave him the robe and the bowl that had come from Bodhidharma. And this was, you know, the symbol. You will be my successor, I give you the robe and the bowl. But now there was a monastery full of students. And Hongzhen said it should stop here because it's creating dissension and jealousy and greed if only one person gets the robe and the bowl. And it did stop there. And from that point on, the transmission of understanding was from a teacher to anyone who really wanted to understand. And we still carry around, those of us who are ordained at least, robes and bowls. But it's not limited. And I find that kind of wonderful, that suddenly the thing flowered. But Huineng, in this story, after his awakening from a teaching by the fifth patriarch, says, who would have expected that inherent nature is intrinsically pure? Intrinsically pure. My nature, your nature. Who would have expected that inherent nature is originally unborn and undying? Always here. So what are they talking about? What are they talking about in this business of seeking for your essence? It's hard to grasp the nature of our basic mind. And I think one reason, maybe not the only reason, but is that it's hard to let in light to your mind if it's like an attic that is jammed with junk and the windows are nailed shut and you're a little bit too tired to go, you know, pry the plywood off the windows. And we sit in the darkness of what we know. All those facts, all those ideas, all those opinions. There is a story that I'm sure some of you know, and it always makes me laugh, about a Japanese Zen master who was very renowned, and he had a visit from a university professor, an intellectual, who had a lot of problems in his life and also a lot of knowledge about Buddhist teachings. And they sat down to have tea, and there were teacups for them and a little pot of tea, and the professor started speaking. And he talked and he talked. He explained his problems. He explained the probable solutions. He gave all the facts. He quoted the scriptures. And as he went on, the Zen master is pouring tea. And the tea filled the cup, and it ran over the edge and into the saucer and was threatening to run onto the floor. And, of course, the gentleman stopped speaking and said, stop, it's full. And the Zen teacher said, yes, and your mind is full. It's too full. I can't get anything into it. We have no reason to speak here. Your mind is full. So we have this sort of conundrum. Knowledge is really important to us. It's what we use to get through life. Facts are important to us. We have to beware of opinion. But they can also be a barrier. They get in the way of anything new. it of our finding what was called in this translation I used, the essence of mind. And the question, of course, is, well, what is that like? There's a very famous exchange. Again, I'm using very familiar teachings here because I think they're a kind of ground base for our understanding. When Bodhidharma, who was an Indian Buddhist priest, came from India, a long, long journey, to China, he was heralded with a lot of excitement because for the Chinese, Buddhism was coming from India. So this is somebody coming from the source. Clearly he's important and he's going to have the answer. There was a lot of discussion about the first principle, the highest meaning. You know, you have the understanding that somewhere back of all this, there's an answer. There's a first principle that underpins everything. And that's what we dig for. We think that that's there. And so did a lot of the Buddhists in China. So when Bodhidharma arrived, he was given an audience with the Emperor Wu of Liang because he was so important. And the emperor, who had was a devout Buddhist and had done a lot of giving of alms and so on, said, "What is the highest meaning of the sacred truth? Give me the first principle." Bodhidharma replied, "Vast emptiness. Nothing sacred." It's interesting. Sacred is an opinion. The sacred truth, that's what we label it. And as you know, certainly here in the U.S., many people have different sacred truths. Sacred truth is a matter of our own traditions, our personal beliefs, and so on, generally speaking. But Bodhidharma said emptiness. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. What in the world is emptiness? Has nothing in it, but everything can be in it. The space in this room is what allows us to be here. You know, we think we're in the room. We're sitting on chairs. We're solid. We forget. No space, I couldn't do that. Space is what allows things to happen. He said, but the emperor then said, "Who is the person facing me?" All right, now here. And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." That was the end of the interview. But that "I don't know" is probably the most important thing Bodhidharma could have said. Because we can't know in any permanent way who we are. So to say, "I don't know," is the most honest answer we can give. The emperor was confused, Bodhidharma went away, and again, the rest is history. But to go on about this, "I don't know," I turn to Dogen, who in the 13th century in Japan was the person who founded the tradition that most of us are practicing in today. And there is a wonderful book called the Eihei Koroku, translated as Dogen's extensive record. Dogen had to do what I'm doing today. He gave a lot of Dharma talks to his own students at his big temple, before that, from the time he had a temple of his own. Afternoon talks, evening talks, some are very short. And when you think about it, year after year, every single day, he was trying to transmit something to those guys who were there, standing, waiting. And this one is Dharma Hall Discourse 304. He says, "All of you people, do you want to understand the first ancestors not knowing?" He's referring to Bodhidharma, who said, "I don't know." "In the house of Buddha ancestors, originally, there is no principle of mind nature, Buddha nature, or consciousness nature." Those are names we have for stuff. And Dogen says, "Simply depending on the combinations of causes and conditions of wind and fire, there are movements and activities. And that's the best description of what myself is that I've ever heard. Depending on combinations of causes and conditions, things happen. And the causes and conditions change, and things change. That's who we are. We are the combination of causes and conditions. Physical ones, mental ones. It's what changes us. We're basically, I feel, what I call me is a sort of response. I'm always responding. Responding now to this room. A different place, a different room, I might say all this differently. Probably would. Because what I am is the coming together of causes, conditions, you folks. So when he says, I don't know, it's absolutely true. Because I can't hang on to this endless flux that is me. I don't worry about it because I have an illusion, a sense that I'm sitting here in this chair, I'm X years old, and, you know, we're having this conversation. But if I really look at it, everything's changing. And what that means is both a little scary, because I can't get my hands on anything. It's also enormously freeing, because there are no barriers. There's no stopping. I can always change. The horizon is always open. I can't really close it. When I try to close it, that's often when I have the problems. So, to go back to what Bodhidharma said, he said, vast emptiness, nothing sacred. Emptiness or space is a container for all things. It has no knowing, but it allows all things to be just as they are, without the knowing that changes them a little bit. I say my left hand. Why left? I say because it's not my right hand. But actually, we don't know. I've given them names. I've given them names. That's useful. I mean, I wouldn't be able to say to you, I'm right-handed if I didn't know. So knowing is, I'm not saying knowing is a bad thing. But I'm saying we have to understand what it is. It's the way we organize the world so we can manage it. So more power to us that we can do that. But be careful, because in our managing, we exclude stuff. And there are barriers, and there are obstacles. And we don't understand that at the center, the essence of our mind is like space. Sometimes you'll hear in the literature, like the sky. Empty like the sky. The clouds float right through the sky. And the mountains rear right up into the sky. And without the sky, you wouldn't have mountains and you wouldn't have clouds. So, it is like space. It's a kind of pure awareness that doesn't yet no, hasn't yet defined anything, but it's ready, it's able, and it will embrace anything that comes up. This is why, to some extent, I think Zazen is so important to us, because when we're just sitting and letting go of our thoughts, or not. As you know, we often pursue them willy-nilly, like it or lump it. But we tend to always come back. You finally let go of it. There are moments when you get a whiff of what allows you to let go or to drift off or whatever it is. It's a kind of awareness. Every one of us has it. It's a huge gift. It's our ability to respond. This, again, is why in some of the very famous Zen stories, you will have some poor student who doesn't get it and doesn't get it and is practicing like mad and sitting like mad and doing everything he or she should do. And finally, he or she goes to the master and says, I can't do this. And the master said, well, don't worry about it. usually, and the student turns to walk away, and the master says, "Barbara," and she gets it. It's her ability. What she's been looking for is to understand that she can respond to her name. Our ability to respond is the greatest gift we have, and we all have it, but we cripple it because we respond with opinions that taint the response. It's a little bit like, "I'm not Barbara, I'm Anna." There's a thing that happens from all this stuff up here in the attic, all my predefinitions. So my response to you is, "Well, I know what that's all about." Do I? No. Everything that happens, happens for the first time. It may resemble the times before, but it's brand new. And yet I've decided, been there, done that. Know all about that. Don't need to work with that one. My mind is like that crowded attic. And knowing, in a way, is that crowded attic or the overfull teacup. All my preconceived notions about how things are get in my way of viewing what's happening right now. I'm either bored sick because I've been there, done that, or I don't like you. I know what kind of person you are. Do I? I've never met you. But my mind is full of images that have to do with age and sex and race and clothing and heaven knows what. And my mind immediately says, "That's who that is." But actually, we don't know. We don't know. I had a wonderful example one day in a conversation like this at the Milwaukee Zen Center with some of our members, and we were talking about Dogen, who is considered to be quite difficult. He isn't if you catch on to him, but when you start, you think, "Who is this guy?" But after a while, you begin to understand what he's talking about. But I was talking about something that someone had said to me that for me was really illuminating about Dogen. And one of my members said, "Who in the world had that wonderful perception?" And I said, "David Hill." And she said, "Well, who's David Hill?" I said, "Well, he's a young black guy who's in prison for a long time for assault, and he's in one of my prison groups." And I could see her mind just wrench around the idea that this guy was smart enough to actually, he gave me some big insights into Dogen. He was reading Dogen. But if you had met, if she had met David, she would immediately have discounted him. His skin is rather dark. He's clearly incredibly intelligent, but, it would have stopped right there. And if she knew when he was out that he was an ex-felon, it all stops. So this attic in our mind can use some clearing out. When we know, nothing else can enter. I tell a story often that I picked up, I think, in a book. Of course, I can't remember her name, but I can't remember the name of the book. A wonderful book by the British woman who is a Tibetan Lama now, wrote a book about, she spent 12 years practicing in a cave in Nepal. And the book is actually talks that she gave after she's been out of that for a long time now and is raising money actually for Tibetan, ordained Tibetan women to be able to study. But in it, there was an experiment described that had to do with three people. An ordinary guy from the research team, a long time practicing deeply talented Hindu yogi and a Zen monk, again, of long-time practice. And they hitched them up to an encephalogram, and the idea was to take a look at their brain waves when they were hearing a random noise. Turned out later it was a door opening, but the point was just this noise was going to happen. And they told them to do what they would normally do, and the yogi went into a trance, and the monk began meditating, and the guy who was none of these things, sat there quietly. And the sound came, and everybody's brain waves went, like, what's that? I think it's the door. The guy in the ordinary guy. So it's not quite so big. The Hindu is interesting because he never responded at all. He'd gone somewhere else, quite literally. But as it progressed, and there was no particular rhythm to it, pretty soon the non-meditator, if you will, the ordinary guy, his mind wasn't responding at all because it's the door. I know what that is. There's nothing there. And the Buddhist monk was interesting because every single time that sound came, the mind went, what's that? Because he knew it was not the same moment. Those sounds were similar, but not identical. Every single time, it's as though his mind came out to say, all right, what's happening now? And I think, what a gift that is, if your mind can leave the trap in here to respond to stuff without the forest of preconceived ideas. They sometimes say that boredom is one factor in boredom is that our brain responds more energetically to impulses it perceives as new. Well, I wonder sometimes if enlightenment is not never being bored, because it's all new every single time. But we decide we've been there, we've done that, and so we're bored. We want something to come from the outside to wake us up. We're not awake. We're waiting for, oh Lord, the iPod, the TV, I can't even name them all, the games, to do it for us. But what's wonderful about the practice here, I think, is we're doing it. When you sit, you see everything that's happening in your mind, you hear everything that the birds are doing. The only interference is this person. And you can sort out a little bit what's going on there. So it's a wonderful practice. It's freeing because you're not dependent on some outside thing to slap you awake or to lull you into, whatever. We're getting along. Okay, I'm going to take a drink of water. I wanted to finish again with one of Dogen's Dharma Hall discourses. I find that I really like these because I get a picture of him all those back there in the 13th century standing up in a cold, Dharma Hall in the evening having to say something to his guys, and there's something kind of moving about it. This is the Dharma Hall discourse number 447, and it's called The translators, who are Taigen Layton and Shohaku Okamura, gave names to these little discourses that relate to what's in them. Dogen didn't name them, and those that recorded them didn't name them. But the translators call this beyond knowing and not knowing. Beyond knowing and not knowing. And so Dogen is speaking. He says, I can remember. And let me interject there. It's fascinating to me. A lot of these talks begin, I can remember. One of the things he was doing was transmitting most of the koan stories from the Blue Cliff Record and Gateless Gate to his students. these talks endlessly, I can remember telling, you know, a conversation between people. It was a wonderful gift because he had been to China, he had read all this stuff, and he clearly had total recall, and he was giving it to them. It wasn't always available to them. I mean, now we dial up Amazon.com and we order up the Blue Cliff record and it arrives in a couple of days. But this was somehow, there's something wonderful about these going over these stories. Of course, he always had his own opinion. And if you read it, as I, for some crazy reason, I did sort of read right through this volume, which is very thick. I began to get a little tired of, you know, so-and-so said something to so-and-so, and you think, all right, okay. And then he says, but I, hey, would say, and then there's something else. I think, all right, all right. So I'm not going to have much to say about this. But Dogen said, I can remember, Guifeng Zongmi said, quote, the quality of knowing is the gateway of all excellence. I think that's true. It's through knowing that we're able to do things, to define this world, to accomplish things. Zen master Huanglong Cixin said, the quality of knowing is the gateway of all evil. Right. They're both right. Knowing is knowing what I want, knowing what I don't have, knowing what I can do to you. Dogen goes on. He says, later students have recited what these two previous worthies said without stopping up to the present moment. Because of this, ignorant people have wanted to discuss which is correct. You know, the whole is knowing excellent, is knowing evil. And for hundreds of years, says Dogen, have either used or discarded one or the other saying. Come down on one side or the other. Nevertheless, Zongmi's saying that knowing is the gateway of all excellence has not yet emerged from the pit of those outside the way. Now, Dogen is starting to differentiate between our usual way of looking at things and those outside the way. And he says, thinking of it as excellent, you're not yet, you're still stuck out there. And he goes on to say, what is called knowledge is certainly neither excellent nor coarse. We call it knowledge. And we say it's excellent, or we say it's coarse. That's our mind defining it. In itself, it's just there. As for Huanglong's saying, Dogen goes on, that knowing is the gateway of all evil, what is called knowledge is certainly neither evil nor good. It depends on how we use it, what we do with it. It can fund the greatest accomplishments, the most enormous compassion, and it can tell you the best way to wage a war. Knowledge is neutral. We make good and evil out of it. But he goes on. He says, today I, Ahei, would like to examine those two people's sayings. Great assembly, would you like to clearly understand the point of this? It says, after a pause. Nobody went, you know. But then he says something that I really love. And so listen carefully. Dogen said, if the great ocean knew it was full, the 100 rivers would all flow upstream. If the great ocean knew it was full, the 100 rivers would all flow upstream. It's because the ocean doesn't know that it accepts everything. But if it said, sorry, full, what would those 100 rivers, which are all of our lives, if you will, do? Turn around and go back. If the ocean knew it was full, the 100 rivers would all flow upstream. So I think he's put his finger on the problem with knowing. Knowing is a great gift, but the problem is it's also the great barrier. When our knowledge, our knowing, shuts the door to our freedom of mind, to our real essence of mind, which is that pure awareness, which has not yet know anything. Always comes out like the monks and says, what was that noise? It's difficult because we need to understand, to get through this world, how things are similar. We need to know it's a door opening so I can go through it. You know, it's the old thing of you don't want to have someone put their hand in fire for the first time, be burned, and then go back and do it again. They have to remember that fire is hot. So we really need to be able to retain our experiences and learn from them. One thing I really like about the way, if you want to call it that, is that it's somehow wonderfully comfortable with paradox. I think many of us think if you've got a paradox, you have to solve it. It can't just be a paradox. You can't leave it alone. It's got to be this or that. But here, our ability to identify similarity is what helps us learn how to get through this world. At the same time, the paradox is that it can trip us up terribly because it leads us to not look closely enough. We look at the general outline and, you know, say it's X. There's the famous story of the man who, was terrified of a snake and later discovered it was a piece of rope. Just saw the shape. Just a trick of the vision. And yet the interesting thing is, suppose it had been a snake. The fact that he leaped back was useful. But the fact that he didn't look closely enough meant he felt foolish. He needn't have done that. So I think, again, when we sit in Zazen, we're instructed a lot to let go of thought. I think some of that is for us to allow the attic to clean itself out, at least have a period of 40 minutes, of which maybe 4 minutes are going to be this thing I'm talking about. But in that 4 minute period, we're aware, just aware. And the fact that it's always there to be found is to me thrilling. Uchiyama Roshi, whose teachings greatly affected my teacher, therefore me, has a wonderful little diagram in his book called Opening the Hand of Thought, talking about Zazen. And I see it in my mind a lot, because it's reassuring, actually. He said, we think that Zazen is this wonderful line right here. Equilibrium, awareness, no distraction. But what happens when we sit down is our mind drifts away and we go above the line. You realize it and you drop back to that place. You get terribly bored with all this and your mind drops below the line and you realize it and you come back. So the process of our sitting tends to be going away and returning, going away and returning. What's wonderful to me is that there is this place to return to. It doesn't change. You can't force yourself to find it, because then you're picturing it, and now that's not it. That ain't it. This is very tricky stuff, because the more you want to do it, the less you can. But if you can let go, it's true. And in fact, what's even worse, I did this, and then I thought, oh Lord, now they're all going to sit and they're going to imagine their minds running up and down. Piece of veal. Because when you're told something, that's what your mind does next. I have a wonderful story about my friend Jiho Sargent, who just died unfortunately, but a wonderful, gutsy American woman who went back in the 70s to Japan, was ordained, and for many years was the assistant priest at Taisoji in Japan, in Tokyo. And Jiho really did not suffer fools gladly. She was fabulously generous. Every time I went to Tokyo in the early days, I could stay with Jiho, and in fact, I wear today, 15 years from the time I was ordained, a koromo that she gave me for my ordination. But she would always, there's a little book of hers called 101 Questions About Zen, and she tends to puncture your illusions about what this is all about. And she told me one time when I was there about one of her very first experiences there in Japan, I think, of sitting Zazen. Went to a very impressive place, and the ambience was wonderful, and it was all very impressive, and a very serious person gave them all sorts of instruction. And he said, now, you know, you're going to sit here. It's a sesshin. It'll be long and hard. But if you really sit for, you know, long enough, at some point you're going to feel yourself, it'll be as though you're lifting right off the cushion, elevating. So Gino said, well, I sat there, and sure enough, I felt like I was lifting off the cushion. And then I thought, oh, you fool, he said you would, so now you are. You'll have the experience that's predicted. I can almost promise you. That's the hard part about our mind wanting stuff. It will produce it for us. But I've always loved a picture of her. She said, and then I didn't feel that way anymore. but it's true that, so I said, you know, forget this bit. it's so it's not an easy process because it can't be forced. We can know or understand that there is an openness available to us. But it changes if we force it, because now we're thinking about it, knowing something about it, imagining what it ought to be. It's very hard to sit here and allow what's happening to happen without trying to make your mind do certain things because you think it's what it ought to do. It's very, very difficult. The other side of course, that is that you can't be too easy on yourself and say, so what? Does it matter? I sat there and fantasized the whole time about the lunch I was going to have. It does matter. So you can't be lazy, but you also can't try too hard. If you try too hard, actually, it's the wonderful thing about Zazen, you will ultimately be very disappointed because it gives you nothing. It allows you to be, which is a very big deal, I think, a wonderful gift. But it won't give you peace. It won't give you enlightenment. I prefer the word awakening, which is more active than enlightenment, which is a noun. And I always think about, you know, running down to the Walmart and getting me some enlightenment, because somehow it's just a thing. But in any case, Zazen allows us to learn a lot in a wonderful way, but it doesn't do stuff to us. It's not a tool, and that's very hard for us to learn. We come wanting somebody to hand us the secret tool, the decoder ring that will, you know, will make it work. And at the same time, I think if we're here to try this practice, it means we're serious. It means we have an honest approach to this. Let me just finish up here. Anyway, what I've been talking about is that when we sit in Zazen, letting go of thought, we allow the knowing to go away, get out of the way. And it's interesting, for this reason, if you think about it, Sung San, the recently deceased great Korean Zen master, talked all the time about don't know mind. Just go straight. Don't know. Don't know. I'm ready to learn, but don't know. And Shunryu Suzuki Roshi you know, his very famous thing was, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's, there are few. Because the expert knows the answers. And the door is shut to other possibilities. And this is why those two wonderful teachers said those things. The beginner is always ready for something. Doesn't know. Ready to learn. And if I can say, I don't know, there's a little space in the attic up here for something else to get in. And having said that, I think it's important to remember that the knowledge in our head is merely the result of the coming together of causes and conditions. It has no real existence. I have a memory of something happening, and it teaches me something. But it's just a memory. And it was of something that was momentary. So we can ease off a little bit, I think. It makes it a little easier to let it go. We don't have to keep going over and over and over stuff. And if we can face our days with a kind of mind of empty space, then I think anything can happen. Maybe the peace and the happiness we were seeking when we walked in will be there. Because anything's possible. And the anything possible is the great promise and the great terror of what the Buddha taught us. Don't be surprised, because anything is possible. What we would call good or what we might call bad. It's all out there. But we are going to experience it most richly if our mind is not closed and already has an idea about it. So we use our ideas, we use our knowledge, and we know when it's getting in the way. You can often look back and say, boy, I went into that with a preconceived mind, idea, and I was wrong. And that's okay, too. So, I think it's time maybe for me to stop and to see if there are questions, comments. Okay, thank you very much for listening.
So, just a few...
No, nope, carry on. But then, if anybody wants to ask questions, I'd like to take them. So, I don't worry. We have about 10 minutes, I think. How are we doing?
Yeah. This is not a question, but a story.
Okay.
Over a dozen years ago, I started sitting, and I went to several sesshins and had exactly the kinds of experiences you're talking about, where I struggled with sitting and think I was making progress, and then worry about not making progress.
Yeah.
One day, this was in Evanston, and I was crossing the street with someone else to show them a Buddha figure in a store down there. And it's a pretty busy street, and there's a traffic light. We jaywalked across the street because the traffic light had held up the traffic. And as we were walking up to the store with the Buddha figure, the sidewalk is sloping. The store next door was a shoe store, and there was a woman in a wheelchair there being minded by some young girl, maybe 11 or 12 years old. And the wheelchair started rolling down the sidewalk toward the curb just as the traffic light turned green and the traffic started to flow. And without thinking, I stopped and grabbed the wheelchair as it went by, and actually stopped right on the brink before it went into the traffic. And that was a product of Zazen.
When we talk a lot about prajna, and there are many ways to describe what it is. One thing that for me works is that prajna is described as wisdom or deep intuitive knowing, or there are various things. But I think prajna is the innate knowledge of what's appropriate at this moment. It just happens. And you're in sync with the universe at that, and what the universe needs at that moment. Yeah, it's the ability to act within the action without thinking about it. That's great. Anybody got anything else?
I'm curious about what the young man told you about Dogen that turned it around for you. Is that a story that...
I'll try to be quick. He had been reading Dogen, and actually his comment was from reading Dogen. It wasn't quite so much about Dogen. But we were having a pastoral visit, a private interview instead of the group thing. And in a room at Green Bay Correctional, there's a large kind of visitor's room, and everybody sit at little tables. You can't leave the table, but you and your inmate relative or whatever it is sit there. So the room was quite full. I disrupted it by bursting out laughing. David came in, and I said, "What do you want to talk about?" And he said, "Well, I've been thinking." He said, "You know, you talk all the time about living in the present. You know, living in the present." He said, "I've been reading Dogen, though, and thinking about it." And he said, "Now, you say we should live in the present, but isn't the present always the past?" Oh my Lord, by the time when I know it's now, it's gone. Now is the past. He said, "Aren't we observing the past when we say we're in the present because it's gone so quickly?" He was right. Absolutely right. That's how fast everything changes. By the time we've recognized it, it's a little snapshot. What happened a millisecond ago? It's long enough to see just that. But what I'm seeing is ever so slightly offset. It's the past. Yeah. Well, that was a fabulous perception of the way things really are. All right. Carry on.